My pleasure.
And the reason I called my book Good Food for Everyone Forever is that it really ought to be possible, in fact it ought to be quite easy, to provide everybody who is ever likely to be born into this world to the very highest standards, both of gastronomy and of nutrition, or put it the other way around, both of nutrition and of gastronomy, basically for the next 1 million years. And after 1 million years, our descendants could work things out for themselves, but they could probably start thinking about the following 1 million years. In other words, there's no reason why our species should not be living on this planet effectively forever, living rather well, and in the company of our fellow species. There's absolutely no reason for wiping other creatures out in the way that we're doing. And at the moment, a conservative calculation says that 50% of all other species in the world, that's about 4 million out of an estimated 8 million, nobody knows how many species there are, but 8 million is a good sort of ballpark guess. Half of them are in imminent danger of extinction. And I think that's a very conservative figure. Because I don't know if you know that DEFRA has just brought out the report about wildlife in this country. And it says basically that most of the species in this country are on the skids. We're talking about the next 30 years. They'll disappear, probably, most of them. And you can see this every day in your own experience. I mean, when I was a lad, and you know, just after the Second War, if you left a piece of fish, say, lying in the kitchen for about a minute, it would be covered in flies. I mean, this was South London, it's not the heart of the country. And actually, although, you know, I was quite interested in natural history even in those days, there would be several species of fly. There would be about half a dozen different species of fly in the course of a few minutes if you were foolish enough to leave it out. You can leave things out all day these days. You can leave a piece of fish lying in the kitchen to thaw out, if that's what you want to do, all day, and there won't be a fly, because there aren't any. They haven't exactly gone, but they're seriously on the skids. And we used to dig in the garden. This, again, was South London. Every time you dug, centipedes would run away, wood lice would pop up, millipedes now and again, ants all over the place, worms. Nowadays, you can dig all day, and you might see one. I mean, the rate of disappearance of those creatures is just horrendous. You can see it before your eyes, and the birds depend on these, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The wonder to me is that anything survives at all, frankly. I wonder that there are as many birds as there are, because what on earth are they feeding upon? At the same time, if you look at the world as a whole, you find, look, there are 7 billion people in the world at the moment, and it's easy to feed 7 billion people. But in fact, 1 billion people are chronically hungry. That's a United Nations figure. Every now and again, some of those 1 billion slump into famine, and then they appear on the telly, and then we have a red nose day to bail them all out. But actually, that's not the answer. The point is that the whole thing is designed in such a way, insofar as it's designed at all, that you are bound to get a proportion of the human species starving, because if you have a market economy, only the winners win, and you know the people that are starving are actually the losers in an economy which is designed to create losers. So, 1 billion out of 7 billion are seriously, chronically undernourished and occasionally starved. Another 1 billion, as we probably all know, are overnourished. So that, in particular, their heart disease and all that stuff, obesity, various cancers, diabetes is the biggie. The population of diabetics in the world at the moment exceeds the total population of the United States. Of that 7 billion as well, 1 billion, according to the United Nations, I'm not making these figures up, live in urban slums. And there's a sort of, it's become fashionable in some circles to say urban slums are actually quite nice. If you go to, you know, say, Rio, you find what is called a vibrant society based on the slum, where people recycle old tin cans and stuff like that, and they have dog fights and all sorts. It's terrific fun. But, you know, it isn't actually very nice living in an urban slum. I mean, I have wandered around them. I've never lived in one, but, you know, I've seen them. They're not nice. And, of course, the lifespan is very short for the people that live there. And 1 billion out of 7 billion is an extraordinary number, because half of the world's population at the moment now live in cities, which is 3.5 billion. And if 1.1 billion live in slums, that means that one-third of all the people who are now living in cities the world over are living in slums. And yet all the policies of the world, all the strategies of the world, seem designed expressly to take people out of the country and get them into the cities, because that seemed to be progress. And then, of course, I just said, you know, it spreads to other species so that half the other species are in danger. And then there's the climate change and the deforestation and the pollution of the oceans and the whole lot. I mean, the fabric of the world itself is falling to pieces. I mean, it's being ruined before our very eyes. And the question is, the point is, that it's just not necessary. It needn't be happening like that. It could be perfectly possible, as I said, for us all to live very well, and to live very well without causing all this damage. And what makes it such a disaster is actually the strategies of what one might call the powers that be. The powers that be being present-day governments, big industry, corporates is the sort of usual culprit, but industry as it's now constituted, the big banks, finance capitalism. And all this is supported, I would say, to their shame, by a whole phalanx of intellectuals, particularly scientists and economists. I was sort of brought up as a scientist, that's what my education is, and we were always brought up to believe, sort of in the 1950s and 60s, that, you know, science was about discovering the truth and what is true about the world. And we were all brought up to believe that the purpose of science, insofar as it had a purpose, apart from discovering the truth, was to serve humankind. And now, actually, most of the research in this country, certainly in the field I'm going to talk about, which is agriculture, is financed by big industry. Insofar as it's financed by government, government will finance, broadly speaking, only those bits of science, only those bits of high technology that can be fed into industry, which in turn will make lots and lots of money. In other words, science, the great discoverer of truth, has become the handmaiden of the powers that be, basically the handmaiden of big business, helped by government, helped by our taxpayers' money. And I think that's an absolute disgrace. What I really want to talk about, though, is how we're going to change it. Now, there's three ways in which you can change the way the world is. And one is to have an enormous fight. One is to have a revolution. And I actually don't recommend an enormous fight, because A, it's not going to happen. It's tremendously hard to organise, I should think. I've never done it, but I would guess. And B, it's not going to happen. Nobody really wants it, a country like this. But also, actually, I think it's a very bad idea. Because if you have an enormous fight, well, all political action has non-linear effects. You can't tell how it's going to turn out. But revolutions are more non-linear than most, more unpredictable than most. And most revolutions never turn out, or don't turn out, the way that their perpetrators want them to. You get civil war and it goes on for decades, and so on and so on and so on. So revolution, not a good idea. A second way of bringing about change is by reform. And what reform in practice tends to mean is that well-meaning people spend their lives trying to persuade government, or trying to persuade Tesco or Monsanto or whatever, to change their ways. And frankly, I think that's a waste of life. I did waste a bit of life trying to do this. And after a few years, you might get yourself an interview with a cabinet minister, and it'll last about 2 minutes, and thank you very much and good night, and we'll look into it. That's a waste of time, absolute waste of time. My wife, actually, Ruth, who should be here but can't, is running something called an all-party parliamentary group, which aims to get politicians regularly on board to talk about important things. And that sort of reform might be worth it at that sort of level. But at other levels, I can't see that it's really worth it. The third way to bring about serious change is what I think really matters, and that is renaissance. And renaissance obviously means rebirth. But what it means in this context, or what it means in any context really, is that a group of people, start just to do things differently and create something different in situ, as it were, without asking the powers that be for permission, without seeking a fight with the powers that be, but just do it in situ, make something different happen. And that's what I think we should be trying to do. I want to focus, I think these generalisations apply more or less across the board, but I want to focus on agriculture, Firstly, because I've been interested in agriculture about 40 years, so I think I know something about it. But secondly, because actually it's astonishing that it seems to me that big governments like ours just don't take agriculture seriously, even though it's the most important thing there is. And if you look at the succession of secretaries of state for agriculture over the last 20 years, and ask yourself if any of them actually know anything about agriculture, the answer comes back, no. And they're given, the job of Secretary of State for Agriculture is given to people who are, in quotes, usually considered to be a safe pair of hands, and these either are people like Margaret Beckett, who are just sort of, you know, they don't know what to do with because she's had her career and she's on the way out, so they give her agriculture. Or they're people like David Miliband, who, it's a little known fact, was Secretary of State for Agriculture for about 6 weeks because he was on the way up and they didn't know what to do with him for 10 minutes, so they gave him agriculture. And that is the way governments treat agriculture, and they treat it, as the expression is, as a business like any other, and none of them get seriously stuck into it. None of them understand it. Governments, on the whole, don't actually take it seriously. I want to suggest that agriculture is the thing we have to take most seriously of all, and it's an intuitive and obvious point. We have to take agriculture seriously because that's what produces food, and we can't do without food for 24 hours. We can't do without it. We can't do without it for a day. We have to have a constancy of supply. You could hold up the supply of computers or the supply of Mercedes Benzes for a week or a year, and we wouldn't actually die. But if you hold up agriculture for a week, half of us will die. It's you've got to keep doing it. You've got to do it well. Secondly, it is actually still, despite the government's best efforts, the world's biggest employer. About 2 billion people in the world are employed in agriculture. That's how they earn their living. And if, you know, being that size intrinsically makes it probably the most important single thing that human beings do, even if it wasn't useful, which of course it is. And the third thing about agriculture that makes it absolutely crucial is that it is where the human species interacts with nature on the biggest possible front. So the third of all the land in the world is devoted to agriculture, and that includes most of the most fertile land, because the two-thirds that are not dedicated to agriculture include, for example, Antarctica, which is huge, but it's not very farmable, and includes the Himalayas, and includes the Sahara. By the time you've taken out all the land that you can't farm, you find that most of what could be farmed is farmed already. Now, the point of my book, and the reason I called it Good Food for Everyone Forever, is that it really should be possible to feed everyone well forever without wrecking the rest. It is technically easy. And the way to do it, actually, is to organise agriculture as if it was your serious intention to provide everybody with good food. That's what you've got to set out deliberately to do. And you've got to set out deliberately to do that without killing everything else, and without being cruel. And if you set out to produce good food without being cruel, without wrecking everything else, it isn't so difficult. It's a biological problem, and biologically it's not too hard. And I call agriculture that is designed to feed everybody well without wrecking the rest enlightened agriculture. I mean, enlightened is agriculture is a sort of high-sounding expression, but that's all it means, agriculture that's actually designed to produce food, which is what most people, sensible people, would think that agriculture is for. But actually, as it's now designed, it isn't for that at all. If you want to design agriculture that produces, you know, good food for everyone forever, the basic rule is, it's all encapsulated in the rather nice word, agroecology. There's a lot of terrible words floating around the place, one of which is sustainable intensification. And there's all these fancy words that government comes up with. But one modern word which is actually quite good is agroecology. And what that means is that you farm along what are essentially ecological lines. And what that means is that you imitate nature. Because what we want to do, if we want farming that will feed everybody well forever, is to produce enough food, but also to produce it, as they say, sustainably. In other words, we've got to be able to go on doing it as long as we want, and also resiliently. In other words, we've got to be able to go on doing it even though the conditions will change, even though the climate will change, which it is doing, obviously, even though the sea level will rise and all those other things. It's got to be resilient. It's got to be capable of changing direction radically and quite quickly. And nature, actually, more at its best, does this. Nature has been very productive, not maximally productive, but very productive, more or less without interruption. Well, no, not without interruption, but continuously, it never actually gave up, for the past 3.8 billion years. And it has done that despite the most incredible changes in climate. So we've had pole-to-pole ice at times, we've had pole-to-pole tropics at times, and nature all the time has come smiling through. So, broadly speaking, if you emulate nature, you'll be roughly on the right lines. And the question is, how does nature manage to be productive and sustain itself as well as it does, and as resilient as it is? What does it do that makes it like this? Well, excuse me, it's nasty work talking. How do opera singers do it? I've often wondered this. How do they do it? You could answer that while I'm having a little sip. Anyway, nature actually does three vital things. First of all, it is maximally diverse. And there's loads and loads of evidence that diverse ecosystems, there's empirical evidence on the ground, done in the field and in the laboratory, and it's intuitively obvious that if you have lots and lots of species working nicely together, they will use the resources much better than any one species will do on its own. And secondly, the species in a proper ecosystem with lots and lots of species are tightly integrated, so that one species dies and another eats it up. You know, one species excreta is another one's provender, and then that grows up and that's eaten by something else. Integration is the key. And the third thing about nature is that on the whole it's low input, and all ecosystems make use of other ecosystems. So we sit here breathing oxygen that was produced by diatoms in the middle of the Atlantic or possibly the Pacific. So we are borrowing oxygen from another ecosystem. And I saw a nice little documentary on the telly a couple of days ago which said that the Namibian desert is actually fed exclusively by fog that comes off the ocean. It simply borrows the fog and the wind that comes off the ocean. So all ecosystems borrow from other ecosystems. But on the whole, ecosystems make use of what is there. They are low input. And on the whole, never do they mine, and never do they make use of fossil fuel. Of course they don't. So if you take these three basic principles, diversity, integration, and low input, and translate them into farming, what do you get? Well, diversity means basically you have a mixed farm. Lots of different kinds of livestock, lots of different kinds of crops, all grown together. And within them, you have the different species, the different varieties and breeds of each species are genetically diverse. You don't, if you want a seriously diverse system, have clones, which is what we tend to have now, or monocultures. The second thing about how integration when translated into farming simply means integration. I mean, on a traditional mixed farm, you didn't just have lots of species living side by side as if they were in a menagerie or a botanic garden. Everyone was feeding into everyone else. I mean, the classic thing is if you make cheese, you get whey from the milk, obviously, and then you give the whey to the pigs, and so on and so on. And the pigs feed on the remains of the old wheat, you know, last year's wheat, and they fertilise the ground, and then you reap it, and so on and so on. That's how mixed farms used to work in this country. And if you want to see mixed farms really working, go to Southeast Asia and see the ducks and the fish and the rice and the paddy fields and the vegetables and so on, working in an incredibly tightly worked integrated system. And low input in farming terms basically means organic, and it doesn't mean you have to follow all the rules of the soil association, all the conditions, but it does mean that organic farming ought to be your default position. It's what you do unless there's a very good reason to do something else. However, if you have these very diverse and integrated, basically organic systems, they are very complicated. And if they're very, very complicated, they have got to be labour-intensive. And I don't mean labour-intensive in the sense of having lots of coolies and slaves. I mean skills-intensive. Lots and lots of very, very good farmers who know what they're doing. If you have a system which is very complex and is also skills-intensive, there's almost no advantage at all. In fact, there's lots of disadvantages in scaling it up. So actually, the kind of farms that would be diverse and integrated, etc., and serve our purposes, would be small, on the whole, would be small to medium-sized. So that's what you need, small to medium-sized, mixed, etc., etc., etc. Now, you look at these farms sort of superficially, or not even superficially, but just look at them, and you find they are very traditional in structure. They resemble in structure what Britain had in the 1950s, or what Southeast Asia, at its best, still has. And people, the powers that be, including the scientists, or particularly the scientists, tend to look at these systems and they say, well, if they're traditional, they must be old-fashioned. And if they're old-fashioned, they must be bad. And what we've got to do, really, is replace, you know, the traditional crops, the traditional livestock, with GMOs and all that kind of stuff. We've got to put in loads of fertilizer and all that kind of stuff. This is what, you know, real science, real modern stuff tells us. Now, I think there's a lovely irony here, which is that if you want to farm in an enlightened way with mixed and integrated and all that kind of stuff, you have to employ the science of ecology. And the science of ecology is actually very, very subtle. It's really clever, modern stuff. I mean, we're only just beginning to see what's involved. Whereas the science, the kind of agriculture, the industrial agriculture, that depends on lots of chemistry and lots of big machines and GMOs and all that kind of stuff, in principle, is seriously old-fashioned. I mean, this is the kind of science that goes back to the 18th century, the Enlightenment. Pity that the words Enlightenment are the same in both contexts. But, you know, the idea that with science you could understand the world exhaustively, and the idea that with high technology you could control the world exhaustively. You know, it's like the principle of Isambard Kingdom Brunel, who said, if you apply a force and it doesn't work, multiply it by 10 and try again. This is the kind of brute science that belongs to two centuries ago that we are now applying and calling modern. Whereas true modernity is what I'm talking about, agroecology, etc., etc. And just to sort of round this thing up, if you want to farm properly, the basic thing is you divide farming into three. You have, I forget that bit. It's just kind of obvious. The strategy that comes out of this is that you, in a country like any country in the world, really, you farm. Every country, I believe, in the world should strive to be self-reliant in food, which doesn't mean self-sufficient. Self-sufficient means that we, in this country, we'd be growing tea and coffee and bananas and oranges or doing without them. And I think that's silly. Everybody thinks that's silly. What we should be doing is growing wheat and barley and raising beef and lamb and so on and so on. Produce the things we can really produce well, but only import the things that we really can't produce for ourselves. And when we do import them, we should play very well for them and make sure that the people who provide them are not wrecking their own country by doing so. In other words, in general, a combination of self-reliance and fair trade will do it. Now, you might ask, well, is it the case that these small, integrated, etc. farms could actually produce enough food for everybody? Because we're told by the powers that be that we can't possibly produce enough food for everybody unless we have loads and loads of fertilizer and pesticide and GMOs and all the rest. That's the only way we can feed people. That's what we're told. And we're also told that by 2050, we're going to have to increase the amount by 50% to keep pace with demand and rising population, etc., etc., etc. Well, actually, it's amazing how much information comes from on high, from the powers that be, from government and intellectuals and so on. It's actually just plain wrong. And either these people are seriously misinformed or they're lying through their teeth. I don't know which it is. I don't think it matters. The result is that it's wrong and it's disastrous. For example, a guy who really is in a high place, and he's head of the Millennium Institute in Washington and really does know something about agriculture because that's how he spends his life, is a guy called Hans Herren, Professor Hans Herren. And he points out that the world at this moment already produces enough food, in terms of protein and energy at least, which is macronutrients, to feed 14 billion people. In other words, we're already producing enough food to feed twice the present population, which really raises the question of, you know, why is a billion going hungry? And he also points out, or the United Nations itself points out, that although the human population is continuing to rise, it is levelling out. The actual percentage rate of increase is decreasing. So that by the time we get to 2050, we'll have 9.5 billion. But that, according to the United Nations, is as many as the world will ever have. So if we're producing 14, enough already for 14 billion people, why do we need to produce a great... We're already producing enough to feed 9.5 billion, which is the maximum population we'll ever get. So why is there all this present emphasis from on high on productivity? Why are we being told from on high that we need another 50% more food? It just isn't true. It's untrue. But then the question arises, okay, we're now producing enough food for 14 billion people. Where does it actually come from? Does it come from GM and all that kind of stuff and big industrial farming? Well, no, actually it doesn't. 50% of the present food that's produced in the world is actually produced from small mixed farms. It's not actually produced from small mixed farms of the kind I'm talking about. Because the kind of small mixed farms of the kind I'm talking about are the farms of the future, which would be structurally very similar to the traditional farm, but would have all the benefits of modern science, which in the main would be modern ecological science. So the farms of the future could be far more productive than the present ones. But 50% nonetheless is produced from small mixed farms, which not only have not got the benefit of modern ecological science, but in many countries, including ours, are actively done down, actively suppressed by the powers that be, because they're considered to be old-fashioned and they're neglected. They're even considered in some countries to be a disgrace, you know. How dare you farm in these traditional ways where we ought to be having flashy new combines and GM and all the rest of it. But that's where 50% comes from. Another 20% of our food comes either from fishing or from hunting, or people grow it in their back gardens. I mean, literally in their back gardens or in allotments, but it's, you know, just personal production. So that means that only 30% of the food in the world is produced by the industrial means, which the powers that be tell us are the ones we really ought to be focused on. And secondly, it's pretty obvious that the industrial agriculture is already hard up against it. The yields of wheat that we're now getting in this country, averaging 8 tons a hectare, are about as high as we could reasonably expect. And the fields of East Anglia are suffering enormously because of the enormous yields that we're taking out of each year. And we get fantastic yields from cattle. You know, in some parts of the world, or even in this country, there are cattle producing 2,000 gallons of milk per lactation, which means per year, which is 10,000 litres. Well, a traditional cow will produce about 600, 700 gallons, less 3,000 or 4,000 litres max. And a wild cow will produce about half of that. And the cows that produce these fantastic yields can hardly stand up because their udders are so big, and they die of mastitis, or they don't die, but they are not much good after about 3 lactations or even fewer because of mastitis and all the rest of it, whereas a wild or a traditional cow will often go for 10 lactations. So, you know, industrial agriculture with its huge yields, etc., 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 is already hard up against it. Whereas all the people I know third world agriculture well all say that, you know, if traditional farms were given them just basic help, like roads, so they could actually deliver the stuff to villages and so on, they could double or triple their outputs. So if we had any sense, we'd be putting our money behind the people that produce half the food and could double their output. But we don't. The powers that be put their money behind the 30%, which is already almost as high as it can get. The whole thing is actually totally nonsense. I'm running out of time already, so I just address the question, why is it, if it's so obviously easy to produce good food for everybody forever, why do we farm in ways that are so obviously destructive, which so obviously fail to produce good food, leave 1 million starving and 1 million overnourished, etc., 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 and indeed produce food which is far more expensive than it needs to be? And the answer is, well, basically the answer lies with the economy. And in the 1970s, in the early 1970s, I spent several very pleasant years working for the Farmers Weekly, which is where I first started getting involved seriously in farming. And at that time, this British government, as it were, still in the wake of the Second World War, was still regarding agriculture as a public service which produced good food for everybody. But in the early 1970s, the tide began to turn. And I first heard the very chill expression, agriculture is just a business like any other. And by the late 1970s, well, early 80s certainly, Margaret Thatcher had brought neoliberalism on board, the philosophy of Milton Friedman in Chicago, which redefined business. I mean, business traditionally is sort of the backbone of society, you know, private enterprise, etc., civic responsibility, all those things. But after the 1980s, it simply was redefined effectively as a means by which wealth is maximised. And the whole thing was seen, the whole globe world was seen to be locked into one big global market, and the market was seen to be maximally competitive in a sort of neo-Darwinian struggle to get richer and richer and richer. And agriculture was plugged into this neo-Darwinian global market, the same as everything else. And the idea that that farming was there in order to produce good food and in order to produce to look after the fabric of the world really went out of the window and was replaced by the idea that agriculture had, as it were, to pull its weight in financial terms. It had to make more money. Each farmer had to make more money than any other farmer. And farming as a whole had to make more money than other industries could do. And when you think of it this way, you're no longer thinking in terms of self-reliance and things like this. And in the early 21st century, the government under Tony Blair was seriously suggesting that Britain, for example, should abandon agriculture altogether in the same way that we abandoned mining, because we could buy food more cheaply from other places, so why didn't we? I mean, that was seriously on the agenda. They speak a totally different tune now. It's obvious that other countries can't necessarily supply us and don't necessarily want to. And that was seriously on the agenda. Now, if you want to maximise wealth, then you have to do things which are totally opposite to what you need to do if you are seriously interested in producing food. Now, if you want to maximise wealth, whatever the industry, you have to maximise turnover, which in practice means maximising production. You have to maximise what's called value-adding, and you have to minimise costs. And all those things in the context of agriculture are utterly destructive. For example, take productivity. If we were seriously about producing, you know, good food for everyone forever, we would be content with the principle of enough's enough. We would say we already produce twice as much as we really need, just that we don't spread it out possibly properly. We waste it. Why do we want to produce more? But if you want to maximise wealth, you've got to produce more, because the more you produce, the more in theory you can sell. The real trouble for farmers is not that they can't produce enough, but that if they do produce enough, there's only a certain amount that people can eat, so people won't buy the surpluses. So you get gluts, and then the price goes down. So you can't just go on producing more and more and more because people stop eating. What you can do, if you want to maximise production, is waste the surplus. So what we actually do is grow fantastic amounts of grain, for example, and then we feed half of it to cattle. Cattle or other animal, other livestock. Cattle should be fed on grass. They do very well on grass. But no. Don't feed them on grass. Give them surplus wheat, surplus barley, because, and surplus soya, so-called. Because that way you can maximise the production of these arable crops. And nowadays, we have this terrible, because, you know, there's possibly a limit to the amount of livestock you can produce, we've got this new scam, which is called biofuel. So huge amounts of crop is grown for no other purpose than to burn it. And that's seen to be socially responsible, because you're not then using oil. So you grow wheat in order to run your SUVs, or you grow maize. Half the American maize crop, which is hugely important as a food crop, or was, is now used for biofuel. It's a scam. It's written, you know, it's written up as the world's great saviour. It's nothing more than a scam. So that's, you know, that's what maximising yield actually means. And what it means is that there is no ceiling on productivity. Basically, the powers that be are saying you've got to produce more and more and more and more and more. Not because we actually need it, but because that's the way you maximise wealth. And you go on producing more and more and more and more forever until the world itself collapses. Adding value should be a good thing. It means brewing and baking and proper butchery and charcuterie and all that sort of stuff. It also means, you know, ludicrous overpackaging, sending strawberries from Israel to Britain to sell at Christmas and all that kind of stuff. Most of it now, totally gratuitous, total waste of time. The most dangerous thing, however, in modern agriculture, in the idea that business, agriculture is just there to make money, is the idea that you've just got to cut costs. Because cutting costs above all means cutting labour. Now, as everybody knows, that's one thing that's incredibly dangerous. Ever since the 1970s in this country, we've had one animal epidemic after another. You know, BSE, which arose, I think, actually in the 1980s. And then we had the worst epidemic of foot and mouth ever. And we had swine flu, which actually goes over to humans, and bird flu, all sorts of things, one after the other. And the root cause of all of them is a lack of husbandry. There just haven't been enough people to monitor the animals, or the feed has been cut price, all those kind of things, all down to cut price. Government runs around, spends billions of pounds of our money, gives us big warnings about the whole thing. It's almost as if the policy was designed, the strategy was designed by viruses to spread themselves. I mean, it's grotesque. But it, you know, it's deemed to be cheap, because that way you save money. Even worse is that, actually, if it can be worse, even worse is that you cannot have the complex agriculture that we need if you've got no labour. You have to practice monoculture. You have to, you know, because you just don't want to employ anybody. So there are farms in Lincolnshire which have, of 2,000 hectares, certainly of 2,000 acres, which have one labourer, one full-time employee. We also these days, of course, bus in millions and, no, not millions, but thousands and thousands of Poles and Chinese, etc., who are treated like dirt and are then sent away at the end of the season. But we don't talk about that, you know, that's just not relevant. But, you know, that's what you get if you have labour, zero labour agriculture. But the worst thing about zero labour agriculture is that it puts so many people out of work. And I was in India, for example, 60% of the people work on the land, which means 600 million people work on the land. And about 10 years ago, Claire Short was going around India persuading the Indians that they should farm more like us. In our country, only 1% of people work on the land. If you farm like us, she said, you know, you'd be so much more efficient because one person would be doing the job of 600. The only trouble is that there is nothing else, well, two troubles, really. First of all, labour, skills-intensive agriculture can be much better than zero-labour agriculture. But secondly, in a country like India, and indeed in a country like ours, there's actually nothing else serious that people could do. And I was in India a few years ago, and I said to various Indian people who were there to talk to, you know, if you farm like us, you will put 500 million people out of work, which is more than the total population of the expanded EU. You know, all these people would have. What are they going to do for a living? And the answer came back, well, we have alternative industries. How dare you insult us by implying that we can't do anything except farming. So what alternative industries, says I? Well, they say we've got IT. Well, IT doesn't employ 500 million people. It employs 10,000 people. Bangalore is one of the great computer centres of the world. Nobody disputes that. But it doesn't employ 500 million people. Nonsense. And they said we also have tourism. Well, yeah, that also employs maybe hundreds of thousands of people, maybe a few million. But the jobs mostly are lousy, you know, cleaning hotels at 4 o'clock in the morning, etc., etc. Why is that better than farming? You know, so they haven't thought it through. No, well, I think they are thinking it through now. Many governments are thinking it through now. If you don't employ people on the land, you are, you know, there is actually nothing useful for people to do except that.
And we'll have 500 million people making cold calls to the UK.
Yeah, maybe. Exactly.
Probably,
that's exactly it. And in this country, we have 1% of people on the land, and we have a million people out of work. Now, young people out of work, 3 million out of work, but a million young people out of work. It would be very easy for, we should have more than like 10% of people on the land. In other words, we could very, very easily soak up that 1 million and probably 3 million without, you know, and that would be a very sensible and useful thing to do. But no, agriculture is meant to maximise wealth in the short term, and that's not what you do in the short term if you want to maximise wealth. So that's why we need to change things around. I, as Rachel said, together with other people, including my wife, now run something called the Campaign for Real Farming, which is trying to establish enlightened agriculture as the way forward. We also have the Oxford Real Farming Conference. We're also now seeking to establish, or are establishing, a college for enlightened agriculture, which should be at Schumacher College in Devon. which is designed to think through all the ideas that are needed in order to make the transformation that we need. And I have this little idea. We also have something called the Fund for Enlightened Agriculture, which aims to channel cash from people at large into enterprises of an enlightened agricultural kind. And one of my own little schemes, well, it's obvious, and some people are doing it, is that every village should at least buy its own farm, which it should run itself, and there are many examples of people doing that. So there is, in Renaissance actually is happening, but it's got to happen fast, otherwise we're all dead, basically. So thank you very much for listening. I've gone on longer than I should, but thank you very much for listening.
Thank you very much indeed, Colin. So for those who are new to the cafe, we'll take a short break, grab another glass of wine, grab some more nibbles, feel free. By the Jessel, we'll bring around the hat. We work on donations, so please throw in your hat. Very nice. Do come and have a look at the books if you want, and then we'll start again on the discussion. I think we'll use some mics for the discussion so everyone can hear.